the award-winning Your Financial Editor program on 930 WFMD. News from the worlds of business and finance with Your Financial Editor, Chris Murray.
Welcome to another edition of the Your Financial Editor program right here on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD at WFMD.com and as a podcast. I am Chris Murray, your host, and good Saturday to you. A good program laid out for you today. Interesting top stories. Also some interesting economic data, including that jobs report yesterday. And also we heard from Jerome Powell twice this week. He was before the House and then a day later before the Senate for planned testimony and prepared remarks that he had for Congress and the Senate, or for the House and the Senate. So we're going to be going over all that. And then, you know, this is something that breaks my heart to talk about. But, of course, we always address the important issues here on the program. Every year, the Heritage Foundation, just like they did military readiness report that we talked about a month or so ago, they also do economic freedom report. And unfortunately, as far as economic freedom here in this wonderful country, the U.S. has fallen to the lowest level in 30 years when you look at this global index. So joining me in just a little bit, Mr. Joel Griffith. He's a research fellow in the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And we're going to be diving into this index and what it means currently and, of course, going forward. So stay tuned for that. As far as the top stories of this week, one thing I wanted to kind of get back to, you know, we talk about deals when they're announced and sometimes they don't work out. And that's what we saw this week when we saw JetBlue and Spirit Airlines canceled their $3.8 billion merger agreement. They basically conceded there was no path forward after a U.S. judge blocked the deal on anti-competition concerns. So if they had made this happen, JetBlue and Spirit combined, they would have created the fifth largest carrier in the United States. And more importantly, probably, it would have ensured Spirit Airlines' survival because they're just burning through cash and they're struggling with a pile of debt, and it just doesn't look good for that airline. But the Biden administration was taking a victory lap over this because they said that they didn't think it was good for the aviation sector. Merrick Garland said the decision by JetBlue is yet another victory for the Justice Department's work on behalf of American consumers. So they were worried about creating the fifth largest carrier, but now it looks like there's a good possibility that Spirit's not going to make it. So that's going to totally eliminate an option when it comes to people being able to get hopefully cheaper airline prices. So, you know, if they're really concerned about this anti-competition, why don't you break up the technology companies? Well, I'll tell you why, because that's where a ton of people, when they left the Obama administration, that's where they went to work. And that's the same thing that's going to happen here when Biden loses in November. And you're going to see people jumping ship and going right on out to California or wherever they can go, where it is controlled, unfortunately, by technology and media that censors things. So I just think that's an important question to ask, and I brought it up this week when we were talking about it, and we should keep it in our minds. So once again, just like I've spoken about the last couple weeks, New York Community Bank, their stock just dove. And, you know, they really continue to have problems. That's what we saw this week. They got more downgrades from Fitch Ratings and Moody's Investor Service. They got their, their long-term issue rating went to junk status. It was not good at all. They basically said that they found some material weaknesses when they were going over their books again. And it just, the stock got waxed a couple days. Then all of a sudden, you saw some knights in shining armor come to the rescue, including the former Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin. His financial firm And those people got together and injected $1 billion into New York Community Bank to try to plug the holes in the dam. So we'll see how this works out. It did stabilize the stock a little bit, but they're working on new plans. And now you have a lot of new players involved because they have a lot of money at stake. So we'll see how this all works itself out. But that is a very important bank to keep our eye on. And it was just about this time last year when all heck broke loose with some of these regional banks, Silicon Valley, Signature, which New York Community Bank absorbed. It was ugly. And it's really hurting that sector because of the uncertainty. So one of the things we heard, what's the government going to do? There are new and more regulations. When we learned last year, you had people embedded from the government at Silicon Valley Bank. They're literally there. And that happened right under their noses. So here's just a crazy idea. How about people doing their jobs and enforcing the rules and regulations that are already in place? How about that? And by the way, to those of you who do it all day, every day, God bless you. And I sincerely mean that, the people that are in the government or in the bureaucracy that do a stellar job. I have the opportunity of working for some of them, and it's wonderful. And I tell you, all these other clowns just make them look bad. It's really a shame. So I saw from the Federal Reserve that Americans are having a harder time getting approved for loans and other different financial products. So, it wasn't the Federal Reserve, this particular piece. It's another piece that I'm going to talk to you about. But this is a survey that was published by Bankrate.com, and they found that 50% of loans or financial product applicants have been denied since the Federal Reserve started raising rates in March of 2022. Credit card applications have been rejected the most frequently. Americans are basically saying that banks are denying them a new credit card. Others were refused a balance transfer card. Then you had people being denied a credit limit increase on their existing credit card, or they couldn't get a personal loan or a car loan or mortgage, you name it. So obviously banks have been tightening their lending standards in response to the Federal Reserve cranking up interest rates in such an aggressive fashion. So that's taking its toll, like I said, on Americans that need access to credit. A lot of them can't get it, either access or an extension. And then I saw a study that was released on Thursday by a company called Assurance IQ. And last year was really, really hard on people. And this is just another piece of proof of that, because Assurance IQ found that 66% of U.S. adults confirmed in a December survey that they had made sacrifices to pay their expenses during the previous 12 months. 66%. And this was research done on 5,000 individuals, a majority of whom earn $75,000 or more a year. Okay? This is the kind of survey that really gets your attention. So back to that previous story, Americans have been increasingly leaning on credit cards for daily expenses in recent years, because inflation has just taken its toll on families' budgets and individuals' budgets, right? Credit card debt surged to a new record high, $1.13 trillion at the end of December. That was the Federal Reserve piece. It came from the New York Federal Reserve data that I was looking at this week. Looking at it again, we talked about that a month or so ago. But they were talking in this survey, Assurance IQ, they said that their research found that not only do low and middle income households struggle to cover emergencies and unexpected expenses, but they also must make trade-offs to keep up with their regular bills. And this is all self-imposed. When you hear about the government shutting down because they can't control spending, just jump on board, shut it down. One of the main reasons they don't want the government to shut down is because then a lot of people, even if they're very busy, they realize how unnecessary so much of the government is. You don't miss it when they're shut down, you know? So if we're ever, 34.4, coming up on $34.5 trillion in debt, they've done nothing to slow down Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden, and then all of the Republican turncoats who voted for those spending packages. It's going to bankrupt the country. So, like I said, I'm all for it. Maybe I'll get a T-shirt, shut it down. As far as economic data, we saw that the U.S. services industry growth slowed a little bit last month. And there was also a decline in employment. So, of course, inflation remains high, with most of the price pressures coming from services such as housing and utilities, as well as finance and healthcare, recreation, those things. But the Institute for Supply Management said that its non-manufacturing index slipped from 53.4 in January down to 52.6 in February. So as a reminder, a reading above 50 indicates growth in the services sector. The service sector in America accounts for more than two-thirds of our economy these days. Obviously, we're not a manufacturing-based economy anymore. Trying to get back there, I hope, but it's going to take a long time. So if that's more than two-thirds of your economy, and 50 is the break-even number, and you're at 52.6, that is nothing to write home about. That is nothing to brag about. So I wish these politicians would quit spinning numbers and just admit that, you know, we've got serious work to do to get the ship, you know, headed in the right direction. Factory orders fell by 3.6% in January. A big part of that was because of Boeing. So Boeing only had a few orders for new commercial aircraft, and that really impacted the durable goods orders. That number, so that's something we need to keep an eye on for, you know, to keep it in the perspective. It was bad, but it wasn't as bad, I think, as the headline number told us. So then we get into the jobs information from this week. A lot of it, of course, it culminated with the big jobs number yesterday. But going up or running up to that, we saw that the ADP private report came out, just 140,000 jobs added last month. They were only looking for, they being an economist, were only looking for 150, and we got 140 from ADP. And the leisure and hospitality sector accounted for most of those job gains in February. So the leisure and hospitality industry tends to be, for the most part, not your higher paying jobs, right? But they onboarded 41,000 new workers. So that ADP report was light. And then the next day, Thursday, we get the Challenger, Gray, and Christmas planned layoff or planned job cuts report, right? Not talked about a lot, but I follow it during a week like this week because it comes out right before the big jobs number. And the pace of job cuts by U.S. employers accelerated last month. So you see more deterioration in the jobs market. So the new report published Thursday by Challenger, Gray, and Christmas found that companies planned 84,638 job cuts in February. That was a 3% increase from the previous month. It was a 9% jump from the same month last year, 9%. And it marked the highest layoff total for the month of February in data going back to 2009. So when I was sitting here in 2009, what were we talking about? The financial crisis, the housing bust, just, you know, a real serious and deep recession. And we're saying that this is the worst data that they've had since then. That's not very encouraging. So the CEO, or it wasn't the CEO, I think it was the vice president of Challenger Gray and Christmas, said that, you know, as they're starting to navigate this new year of 2024, they're witnessing a persistent wave of layoffs, which we talk about all the time, unfortunately, because businesses are aggressively slashing costs because they're trying to hit their numbers, right? They've got to report earnings. There's only certain ways that they can be profitable: by having a robust, healthy economy with true organic growth, not government spending, or you cut cost to make sure the number is what the number needs to be for the shareholders, so they don't dump your stock and, you know, put your company in a tailspin. So it was very, you know, disheartening to see that number, and then not only down 9% year over year, but the worst number that they've had, worst February they've had since 2009. All right, so on top of that, yesterday we get the jobs report from the Labor Department, which, look, if you've been listening to me, you know, it's, they're once again, they're back to being a joke, the Labor Department, total joke. During the Obama administration, both terms, they were a joke. Even when they replaced a labor secretary, got somebody else in there, they couldn't get the numbers right. They manipulated numbers for political reasons. They were not honest with the American people. And here we are again, right? Because the estimate for new jobs last month was 200,000, right? Well, the Labor Department said that they added 275,000 jobs in February. Much higher than economists were looking for, right? Okay, so then that takes us back to last month. So last month, the Labor Department came out and said we added, in January, 353,000 new jobs. All right? Well, guess what came out yesterday with the February report? The revision for January. So it wasn't 353,000. They revised it all the way down to 229,000. I mean, who does that? That's on purpose. So how can you, like I've said for so long, how can you take these people seriously? They have no credibility. They're either totally incompetent and or are manipulating or trying to manipulate things for political purposes. It's just, you know, and what was the number that they just gave us based on, just like the, you know, we've seen month after month, new government employees. That's just what we need, right? Bigger government. Also, healthcare. Well, guess what? What supports healthcare these days because of Obamacare, Medicare, Medicaid, all that stuff? The government, us. The American taxpayer. So, you know, this report is a joke, just like all the other reports, again, from when Obama was in there for two terms, and this is just his third term. People know that. They realize it. Those guys and girls are running the train station, right? But this is embarrassing. This is totally embarrassing. You don't go, if you even think you have a shred of credibility, you don't go from 353,000 jobs that you announce and then revise it down to 229,000. And then still you're looking at the bulk of these jobs that are being created are in government. It's a joke. So we'll see what the revisions. And you know what? It does make you, me in particular, so thankful and grateful when you have good cabinet secretaries. Like the Labor Department, when Eugene Scalia was in there, There was no messing around. There was no shell game. There was no shuck and jive and, you know, bait and switch, whatever you want to call it. Things were good, they were good. Things were bad, they were bad. That was it. That was it. And again, all the hardworking people at the Department of Labor, obviously I'm not talking about you. I'm talking all this clown car that people just keep getting out of in government these days. So that was a disgrace to see that yesterday. Jerome Powell was before the House on Wednesday and then the Senate on Thursday. Didn't really, you know, pave any new roads. One thing he said on Thursday that caught my attention, he said, quote, "I think we're in the right place," unquote. So he said they're waiting to become more confident that inflation is moving down to the 2% number. And he said, when we get that confidence and they're not far from it, then it'll be appropriate to begin to bring down interest rates. That this has been an epic failure too as well. And he knows it. And, you know, in a job that you're not supposed to be political, the Federal Reserve is totally political. So that's really a shame. But that's it. So we'll continue to watch this stuff and the revisions and to tell you the truth and, you know, just to let you know kind of what's going on. Take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with my guest, Mr. Joel Griffith from the Heritage Foundation. Unfortunately, some bad news when it comes to the Economic Freedom Index, global index that they publish every year. This great country has slipped, and we're at the lowest level we've been in 30 years. So that's not good. But we'll talk to him and break that index down and make sure that we understand it. And most importantly, not just what's bad, but, you know, what can we do going forward to fix things? Because it's time, right? It's time to do that. Back in a minute.
As you brush your shoes and stand before the mirror, and you comb your hair and grab your coat and hat, and you walk west streets trying to remember all the wild night breezes in your memory ever, and everything looks so complete when you're walking
out. Welcome back. This is Chris Murray, your financial editor on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD at WFMD.com and as a podcast. Just go to Apple Podcast. You can grab it there. Thanks so much for being with us. Hope your weekend's going well. And as I mentioned right before the last break, we're going to be jumping into our discussion. So happy to have joining me today, Mr. Joel Griffith. He is a research fellow in the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And the Heritage Foundation recently came out, Joel and his colleagues put together, like they do every year, something that's known as the Economic Freedom Global Index. And it really just looks at literally every country on the globe and puts us in pecking order. And I think it's really important that we have these discussions. We talk about what's good, what's bad. And then as far as what's bad, how can we fix it? Like, what's our role as good Americans? How can we contribute to get us where we need to be? So having said that, Joel, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. I appreciate it.
Hey, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. It really does, at the end of the day, matter to families.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, unfortunately, I was sad to see one of the headlines was economic freedom in U.S. falls to lowest level in 30 years, according to the 2024 Global Index. So I guess if you can help our listeners understand what you guys kind of use, like what are the pieces that you put together to come up with this ranking for each individual country and their economic freedom?
Yeah, and like you said, we are at the lowest rating that we've had in the history of our report that has spanned decades. We're now 26th in the world. We are ranked lower in terms of economic freedom than Singapore, which is at the very top, but we're also ranked below a lot of nations in Europe that used to be quite socialistic, like Denmark, Sweden, Norway. We're ranked below Canada at this point on economic freedom. And when we come up with this rating, we try to make this as objective as possible. We try to bring in data on several important categories. We look at property rights, private property rights particularly, government integrity, judicial effectiveness, the tax burden, and government spending. And, you know, there are a few areas in which our country still is one of the best in the world, if not the best. When it comes to private property rights, we are still very strong, for instance. And even government integrity, even though that has diminished in recent years, we're still in the top third of the world on that. But where we have really fallen by the wayside the last, I would say especially the last 5 years, beginning during the pandemic under President Trump and then continuing under President Biden, has been our government spending and the fiscal conditions of this country. And you can't detach that from economic freedom, because then you have the government expand massively in size. And we did. We saw our government expand in size about 50% over the past 5 years in terms of spending. We're spending $80,000 per family in federal government operations. And when you do that, that means that there is less available for the private sector to employ as they see fit. That constricts economic freedom. And same holds true on the borrowing side. When you have an enormous deficit like we have now, where we've borrowed $400,000 per family, and we're spending $12,000 per family just on the interest on the debt, once again, that siphons off our productivity and our output, leaves much less available to actually reinvest. And, you know, we can get lost in the numbers, but what we're experiencing now in terms of real incomes declining by $4,000 per year and the highest inflation that we've seen in 40 years, that is a direct result of those two factors on our economic freedom index, the government spending and the borrowing and the printing.
Yeah, and we talk about that often on the program, and really you can't talk about it enough, because unfortunately, I always say, I get it, people have busy lives and they're running around putting out their own fires, but you know, we're at $34.4 trillion, almost getting ready to flip to $34.5 trillion as far as the debt goes. And like you said, nothing has happened to to kind of bring that back into a normal range. So I appreciate you pointing out not only the debt, but the interest on the debt and how that's snowballing. And really, you know, I just kind of equate it to the younger generations and, you know, the kids and grandkids and great grandkids. They might as well have a backpack with about 500 pounds of rock, you know, in it, and they can carry that around. That's almost like the debt load we're putting on them. So how much does that diminish their opportunities, you know, for us to care about the younger generations going forward?
Oh, it diminishes the opportunity severely, and also I would say rapidly. If you look at the entitlement situation, Social Security, for instance, for many years since the creation of Social Security nearly a century ago, remember, we took in payroll taxes, and those payroll taxes didn't just go to pay benefits. A lot of those taxes went into a trust fund. The trust fund bought up government bonds, and those bonds were to be sold off in future times as the population aged. Well, for several years now, we have actually been draining that trust fund. We've been selling off those bonds that were purchased basically as investments to pay off those the beneficiaries. Well, it's going to get worse in coming years, because we're estimating by 2034, that's just 10 years from now, there will be nothing left in that trust fund, and that's going to force politicians to make some very difficult choices. And those decisions are going to be harder in 10 years than they are now. They're going to have to decide whether to cut benefits or raise payroll taxes. And payroll taxes here are actually far lower than they are in other parts of the world. If you look at France, if you're a middle-class family, you're spending over 50% of your income to pay your payroll taxes and income taxes if you're a middle-class family. And the third option, and this is the option I think politicians will resort to, is going to be simply using the printing presses of the Federal Reserve to go ahead and just buy up government bonds, which we just saw what happened the last 3 years, sky-high inflation. So we've got to address these problems now because the tweaks will be far more modest, and it won't impact those who are already receiving the entitlements, despite what the left continues to say. But unfortunately, both the Democrat candidate and the presumptive Republican nominee seem as if they are refusing to address this problem.
Yeah, and it's major. I agree. I've always said it's like Thelma and Louise going, you know, speeding to the cliff. I mean, you might as well look at it that way, because it's going to be a disaster if somebody doesn't, you know, take some responsibility and address those entitlement programs. So, you know, you mentioned Singapore being number one, had an overall score of 83.5. I assume that's out of 100?
That's out of 100, and they are just stellar across the board. Property rights are respected right up there along with us. Government integrity in Singapore is actually higher than in the United States. The tax burden, they're in a better situation as well. And of course, they have a responsible government system when it comes to spending. But another important area to point out, particularly in with Singapore and a number of our international competitors, is on this matter of international trade, on free trade. Our country this past year fell to an all-time low in our own ranking on free trade, and this situation deteriorated rapidly under President Trump in his final years, and President Biden's actually made it worse. It seems as if both Republicans and Democrats are peddling this notion that free trade is actually harming us, when the facts show otherwise. If you go back and look at what happened in our country to the middle class following the passage of NAFTA, for instance, the free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, our real family income soared at a faster clip than we've experienced in decades. And that's our middle class income. We saw our actual production on the manufacturing side actually increase to all-time highs. And unfortunately, we have seen a rollback of that. If you look at what happened under President Trump, he put in tariffs, not just on China, but the tariffs also went on Canadian lumber, went on our allies, driving up home prices, driving up the cost of your washer and dryer machine. If you looked to buy a washer or dryer several years ago, you would have noticed this very dramatic bump up of about $100. And we've actually estimated that the impact of those tariffs on middle-class families that were put in place in the prior administration came close to about $1,000 a year on average, and has only gotten worse under Biden. And sadly, there are fewer and fewer politicians on either side of the aisle willing to actually state economic reality, and that is that free trade has actually been a massive benefit to our nation and to our allies.
Talking today with our guest, Mr. Joel Griffith. He's a research fellow in the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And as we see every year, the Heritage Foundation came out with their Economic Freedom Global Index. Unfortunately, we dropped. We're at the lowest level that we've been. And, you know, I mentioned Singapore being number one, but, you know, it breaks my heart when I look at this list and I see United Arab, Emirates, I see Cyprus, Lithuania. I mean, countries that I would assume that we would just eat their lunch when it came to economic freedom and just overall, you know, how we run our economy and our country. But obviously that's not the case based on your index.
No. And this all comes down to the data that we're putting, that we put in this study to make sure that we're being objective about it. It is sad to see us falling. You know, I'd love to see all countries rise in this rating, and we can be competitive about that. And as we're all more economically free, we're all going to be producing more. We're all going to have human beings thriving more. The pie will keep on growing. And unfortunately, we're self-sabotaging. And if you look, too, another finer point of the economic freedom is on the regulatory side. And if you look at what the current administration has been doing in just crimping supply with regulations on labor, on the environment, on energy, we're self-sabotaging ourselves. We're making it, you know, we hear politicians on both sides talk about we want more manufacturing. And I'm all for more manufacturing, but why is it that we are harming the ability of our factories to actually get affordable energy? Industrial electricity is one of the most important components of production. And yet from day one, Biden has been killing pipelines. He's been sending signals that he wants to put the fossil fuel industry out of business. He is blocking efforts to actually construct new natural gas terminals. All of this not only drives up costs now, but it sends a signal to investors that this nation might not be the way to park capital and might not be the place to start building new factories and new infrastructure, because if this administration has its way, they're going to clamp down even more on that energy sector.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we're hearing that, you know, more proposed regulation and restrictions and red tape. And, you know, we always say, look, if you're one of the major corporations, it's tough. But if you're a medium-sized company or a small business owner, you're just getting steamrolled because you don't have the deep pockets, you don't have the line of credit, you can't go to the capital markets, you know, nobody's there to bail you out. And that's the real heartbreaker. And like I said, they're talking about more of it constantly, and they know they can't get it done with votes. So what do? Is they circumvent, you know, Congress in the right process and go to a three-letter agency and start pushing stuff through them that most of America doesn't even know about, they're not aware of.
Oh, no, yeah. A big part of my job every day is combing through some of those dense legal literature you'll ever read, but it's very important because it's the regulations that hundreds of agencies are actually issuing, and they have the force of law. Congress, in many cases, has abdicated its responsibility to legislate and has empowered these agencies of unelected bureaucrats to create the law that we all have to abide by. We're talking tens of thousands of pages of federal regulations. It is adding up. In fact, I saw an estimate the other day that says the combined costs of all these regulations per employee in the manufacturing sector, for instance, is upwards of $30,000 annually. We're handicapping ourselves on this. And if you look at a place like Singapore, just give you a sense of the regulatory efficiency in a place like Singapore, you can go file your paperwork to get your business off the ground and be up and running, approved within weeks. Try doing that in the United States.
Yeah, it's impossible. Even if you try to walk it through yourself, or if you have legal counsel to help get you through, it's just it's not going to happen because of that regulation and red tape. So the preface of the Heritage Foundation's Economic Freedom Global Index, your president had an interesting quote. He said, to defeat progressive elites, we must defend the efficiency of free markets, but more importantly, the morality of free markets, the dignity they give every human person to create, serve, and reap the fruits of his labor. I mean, that's just old school common sense. How successful are you guys in getting this out there, especially to, you know, elected officials and bureaucrats that are making these decisions?
Yeah, well, I know that we are pleased with how this report and our analysis has aided other countries, a lot of their up-and-coming leaders, in throwing off the shackles of communism, socialism, and statism. We've developed a lot of great relationships with friends across the world, and they're seeing those results. And I love how Dr. Roberts, the president of Heritage Foundation, couched this in moral terms, because this isn't just about money and capitalism. This is about preserving the ability, restoring the ability of each of us to choose what we do with our own resources and our own time. And when you have layers of regulations, when you have wealth confiscation, or you have restrictions on what you're going to do with your private property, that's all an assault on freedom. And it's also directly related to our ability to care for our families, to even start families. When you have Washington, D.C., telling you what you can and cannot do with your capital, and then taking away sometimes half of what you've actually earned, that diminishes the ability for you to care for your own family. And it also impacts your ability to actually use those resources to help others in non-business ways.
Yeah, and I agree with you that, you know, that it is a moral issue, and I enjoyed reading that myself. And, you know, I guess the other thing is, you know, so I've been following Heritage for years and years, and we have at least a minimum of, you know, we have a weekly program here, and it's a minimum of one Heritage scholar like yourself, excuse me, sometimes two, because of the information that you guys create, that it's honest, it's accurate, and it's really beneficial for everyone to hear and to learn about. But I've noticed the last year or so, and I give a lot of credit to, you know, your president, Mr. Robertson, others that at the foundation who've stepped it up a little bit. And you guys really are seen now as you know, you're inside the ropes, you're in the ring, and you're throwing some really good punches. That when I say that, I mean it's common sense and it's for the betterment of our country here. Are you starting to feel a little bit of heat from that?
Oh, there's definitely some heat, because there's a lot of individuals, even some businesses, that stand to benefit immensely from the government actually dictating how our economy develops. And if you look at what's going on in the green energy sector, and the electric batteries, and the electric vehicles, and the charging stations, and the windmills, and the solar panels, they're making billions of dollars off the backs of us that we're paying for in terms of higher taxes, but also higher electricity costs. That's just one area. If you look at the gathering that happened in Switzerland just about a month or so ago that actually Dr. Roberts spoke at to these world leaders, he spoke very clearly to them. You know, they have made it as their stated agenda that they want to dictate to us how we drive our energy, the food we eat. Now, these are essentials to having a comfortable lifestyle that a lot of us, including myself, have taken for granted. But our lifestyle and our prosperity here, which is unprecedented in human history, didn't come about by happen chance. It came about from actually proceeding with a society built on these fundamentals of economic freedom. And unfortunately, a lot of world leaders are conspiring with our own leaders here to put shackles on us.
When it comes to the whole climate hoax, I mean, I've said for years, that's just they're just laundering money. That's all they're doing there. It's about power, money, and control. And I loved it when Dr. Roberts said at Davos that, you know, he looked at the elitists and said, you are the problem. I mean, he spoke for so many people around the world when he did that. And I was just thrilled when that happened. So the last few minutes we have here, let's focus on, you know, we've continued to slip down the rung. And it's hurtful, but what do we do? Like, what are the top three or five things that we need to do to change our course of trajectory, so it's up instead of down?
Some of this is contingent on a friendly administration and the right Congress, but to tell you exactly what needs to be done, one is to actually get this regulatory system under control. This is going to require continuing to file lawsuits, but also have Congress come in there and actually rewrite the mandates for these agencies, and in some cases, close these agencies down. Congress has the constitutional power to do that. They've unconstitutionally delegated power in many instances. So Congress needs to actually address these shortfalls, and you know, we're very happy to give them the information to assist with that. But number two, we have got to address the fiscal situation in this country. If we don't make changes now to the primary cost drivers, we are going to, at best, in the longer term, experience much slower growth and higher inflation. And at worst, we end up in a situation like we've seen in Argentina over the years, where they've got triple digit inflation because they failed to get their system under control. You can go from being one of the most wealthy countries in the world to impoverished in the span of a generation or two. It's happened in multiple countries in South America. And once again, Argentina, Venezuela, the leading examples of that, two of the wealthiest countries in the world. Now, Venezuela in particular is one of the poorest countries, actually the poorest country in our hemisphere. So we have to avert that damage now. And then on the printing side, the Federal Reserve side, look, they have been instrumental in financing our government's borrowing operations. If you look at a chart of the assets of the Federal Reserve, which is basically the money they printed, it skyrockets. It looks like a hockey stick starting during that COVID era. They acted incredibly irresponsibly. And although, of course, it's important to maintain political independence when it comes to certain aspects of their operations, it's certainly within the realm of Congress to put restrictions as far as the extent of the money printing and the assets that they can be purchasing. We're dealing with that now, and not to belabor the point on the Fed, but if you look even at our housing prices, which are the least affordable in national history, well, the Federal Reserve is largely responsible for that, thanks to them printing trillions of dollars to buy up mortgages, which just delivered even more capital in the real estate space. We're suffering from all of this. Those are three areas that I think the next administration, the next Congress, should tackle immediately.
Yeah, and that everybody that listens to this and cares about the country, they need to to, you know, kind of process that and make sure that when they're casting their one vote, that that it's for, you know, the right person for the right reasons, for sure. Our guest today has been Mr. Joel Griffith. He's a research fellow in the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And the good news, go to heritage.org. And you can get all of Joel's info. You can get a free copy of the index, the Economic Freedom Index that we've been talking about today. It's all there, plus a ton of other stuff. And also sign up for their daily email, the Daily Signal. That's got great information every single day in a variety of areas. So, Joel, thanks a lot. I appreciate you taking the time, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thanks for the opportunity to be on.
Absolutely. Enjoy your weekend. And that does it for us. We will talk with you on the Morning News Express with Bob and Chris. Those are weekday conversations, 5:50, 6:50, 7:50 a.m. And talk for a few minutes about business and finance or whatever's going on. And excuse me, you know, on Friday, that jobs report came out, and I was already off the air with Bob and Chris, but we've been texting, and it's such a joke. I can't wait. I got to rip it here, but I can't wait to until Monday when we get after it, because it's just it's embarrassing. So yeah. So anyway, we'll talk with you on the Morning News Express, and then right back here next Saturday for another edition of the Your Financial Editor program. This is Chris Murray wishing you and your family financial success.
Play a guitar just like a ringing